Hi, this is Evan Long, reporting for evanlong.tk and the columbinecause.tk. Today is Sunday, December 13th, 2009. Welcome to Unraveling the Sheriff's Official Line. Rolf Sechmar is a longtime Columbine shooting researcher who's been on the case for over 10 years. His many writings on the internet, often posted under the handle Star Viego, have introduced whole new audiences to a relatively unpublicized side of the attack, one which has been derived from the government documents related to it. In addition to working with the Columbine evidence, Rolf has also made connections between the profiles of other random rage spree killings, such as Red Lake, Virginia Tech, and Northern Illinois University. His work deserves the attention of anyone interested in any aspect of the mass shooting phenomenon which plagues society today. Rolf was good enough to talk to me and give his thoughts on the Columbine shootings and related events. By way of introduction, Rolf first began researching the case shortly after the shooting took place because he was skeptical of the official story. He later joined with other researchers on the internet, where he became a key contributor to efforts to expose the discrepancies between the official version and the facts as he and others had uncovered them.
Well, I started my research at the Columbine, I guess, on the day it happened. I was at a friend's house, and he suddenly drew my attention to the TV screen. I just caught a snatch of what was happening: two high school boys attacking their school. And I thought to myself, that's kind of odd. Why would two seniors gun down people at their school just a couple of weeks before graduation? And you may have heard some of the early motives given was that they hated the school. Well, if they hated the school, why did they just drop out like so many people do, or wait 5 weeks before graduation? So I just thought that was kind of curious, and I started to read all the newspaper accounts at that time. I didn't have internet then, but I started to read through the newspapers, and I noticed that one of the interesting things, the eyewitnesses described shooters and gunmen, but they never identified them as being Harris or Claybolt, though. I looked quite carefully through all the accounts and all the newspapers, and I could not come across one eyewitness that used the word Harris or Klebold to describe the gunman. And that caught my attention early on. And then I started going to the internet. I noticed the Columbine Research Task Force had been set up, and I thought they were doing some great research. And then from that point on, I was really sucked into it. And later on, I began to read all the online documents from the officially released sheriff's documents. And the more I read, then the more I got sucked into it, and I started to pick out more and more anomalies in the official account. A couple of years after that, the CRTF kind of went into kind of arrest mode, and a group of us from the CRTF, the Columbine Research Task Force Board, we formed our own group, the Echoes of Columbine, and that site is still up, thankfully. That's one of the few places on the net where you can really hear about the Columbine story.
Rolf's early research suggested that an underrepresented portion of those connected with the incident were disapproving of the official version. For instance, a Columbine parent named Christian LaPlante was quoted by Extra Daily News as saying, quote, "We can't be so stupid as to think two teenagers did this. Two adults couldn't have done this."
Mr. LaPlante, he was a parent of one of the students there, and I picked up that quote because I got indications that a lot of the parents and the people there did not buy into the official version of events. Now, that was not covered by the media very well. It was just a little snatch here and there. But as usual, you know, that the media was running interference for the police and the official version of events. There was very little in the media coverage that indicated that there was any dissent as to the conclusions from the police department. And he was not the only parent that expressed doubt. There were several others, and I thought it was important to emphasize that not everybody, even then, even on the scene, believed the official version of events. That included the parents.
About 13 months after the attack, the Jefferson County Sheriff's Office released a comprehensive presentation concerning the conclusions of their investigation into it. Titled Sheriff's Office Final Report on the Columbine High School Shootings, the sheriff's official line maintained that not only had Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, two Columbine seniors who had been found dead at the scene, been the only attackers on 420, but that none of their friends or associates had any foreknowledge of the plan. Soon afterward, the government began to publish their once-secret internal documents, which had been generated during the various phases of the investigation. 11,000 pages of investigative files, also known as the 11K, was released in November 2001 and gave a disturbing new window into the shootings, which was a major break in the case for researchers like Rolf.
The eyewitness accounts is what you have mostly in the 11K, the student eyewitness accounts. And it was at that point that I began to realize that a substantial portion of the eyewitnesses, the students, and the teachers did not support the official theory of only two shooters. Now, in those documents, they didn't reveal, for example, the identities of other persons identified. They had them in redacted form. They would say this person saw a redacted shooting. However, I was able to glean many of those anomalies and put them into a list format where they could all be seen at once.
The revelations spurred by the release of the 11K as compiled in Rolf's postings led to renewed interest in the case around the internet, and Jefferson County came under further pressure to release the remainder of its files. In 2003, a major boost was given when the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, which had also responded to the shooting, released a report titled Reinvestigation into the Death of Daniel Robaugh at Columbine High School on April 20, 1999. These files expanded upon what had been presented in the 11K.
The El Paso documents are primarily valuable. They went over many of the same interviews that the Jeffco County Sheriff's Department did, but they did not redact the names critically. And we see in the El Paso documents the names of the other students that were identified by the eyewitnesses. And, of course, those students were Robert Perry, Chris Morris, Joe Stair, and Brian Sargent.
According to what was now in the public domain, several witnesses to the shootings had named Columbine High School's trench coat mafia leader Chris Morris as a shooter, and approximately two dozen described or named TCM member Robert Perry as the same. Still more described or named then-CHS Jr. and TCM member Brian Sargent as a shooter, and at least one put TCM member Joe Stair on the scene that day. Significant not only due to his past threats to blow up the school, but also because he had graduated the year prior. In addition to these facts, several ear witnesses also told of a gunman shouting, "Joe, where are you? I've got three of them in here," during the course of the siege. Many of the witnesses who ID'd these individuals revealed that they knew precisely who it was doing the shooting because they knew them personally or from having seen them around school.
Eyewitnesses knew who it was. As I said, over 40 eyewitnesses put a name to these other shooters, and that name was not Harris or Klebold. So, yeah, many of the students knew who they were. How did they know who they were? Well, two of them were current Columbine students, Morris and Sargent, just like Harris and Klebold were. Other two were recently departed Columbine students, Stair and Perry. So you did have many of the people there who recognized them. And as members of the Trenchcoat Mafia, they were particularly noticeable. They had very distinctive features, of course. So these eyewitness reports, you just can't discount them as being wrong. You have to realize that they were probably correct.
The other named suspects were rounded up within hours of the attack, but despite relatively weak alibis, they were let go just as quickly.
Checked out their alibis either, did they? And if their alibis were always close friends or family members, which is known to be a not very reliable alibi, obviously, because close friends and family members will always cover for you. Multiple eyewitnesses saw them, so he could not have been alibied and been on the scene at the same time. The sheriff naturally made the decision, and that decision was to stay with Harris and Klebold only.
The reported involvement of these others was officially addressed and dismissed in a final report file called Trenchcoat Mafia and Associates. With the other suspects out of the way, the official focus would remain on the now very silent Harris and Klebold. However, if other attackers were involved, as the many corroborating witnesses alleged, Eric and Dylan may not have been the only ones who committed serious crimes at Columbine.
I don't know if the evidence against Klebold or Harris is really that good. I'm certain that they were on scene, that they were shooting, but as you have other shooters, you really can't ascribe every death to Harris and Klebold. We don't know who really shot who.
According to the sheriff's timeline, the shootings officially began outside the school on the west stairs next to the cafeteria. This scene was witnessed by many students who stated that it was specifically not Harris or Klebold doing the shooting, that it was specifically other individuals whom they recognized, or that it was three or more individuals. Officially, after shooting outside, Klebold made a brief, unexplained foray into the cafeteria, where he did not shoot, then rejoined Harris outside. Officially, the two then entered the school through the west main doors. However, at this time, when the cafeteria's surveillance cameras are conveniently missing 8 minutes of footage, many witnesses reported shooters attacking the cafeteria and other, more remote parts of the city-like campus.
Some said they saw Harris and Klebold up there. Some said they saw Perry, a sergeant could have been there. Chris Morris may have been there. Joe Stare, another Trenchcoat Mafia, was seen on the scene. So I personally believe that there were probably multiple teams being assembled at the top of the stairs there. One of them started shooting outside and went through the entrance of the school. Another team went down the stairs and entered the cafeteria, possibly at a different time. And the police, of course, made it seem like there was just two and that they entered the west side of the school.
Although only four firearms, two shotguns and two semi-automatics, were allegedly used in the attack, many witnesses described the sound of automatic gunfire as having been heard outside and throughout the school. Also, witnesses to the alleged sale of Klebold's Tech 9 pistol, which netted the only two prosecutions directly related to this case, those of Phil Duran and Mark Maines, described the buyer as having had acne. At no time during the 1998 to 1999 school year did Dylan Klebold have acne, but it was reportedly a distinctive feature of accused Columbine attacker Robert Perry.
The two kids that witnessed that gun transaction, both were presented with a photo array of suspects, and both of them picked out who they saw there at that point, but that person who they picked out was not identified. Isn't that interesting? Obviously, if it had been Harris or Klebold, they would have said, "This is Harris, this is Klebold." I think the person they were describing was another Trenchcoat Mafia member named Robert Perry, who was, as you know, identified by numerous people as being involved in the Columbine Massacre.
Many other points about the official version are suspicious according to evidence found in the documents. One is that some of the deaths may not have happened the way that they were officially described.
There's a fair amount of other anomalies. For example, who killed Dylan Klebold? We don't know. They said he killed himself, but that doesn't look likely. There was another victim, Stephen Kernow, in the library. They said he was shot by a shotgun round, yet there was pieces of a .223 police round on his body. Who knows what happened there? The teacher killed there, Dave Sanders, the Columbine teacher. The final report did say that the bullet that passed through his body could not be matched to either one of Harris or Klebold's weapons. So in that instance, at least, you know, we don't know who shot him either.
Another point about the tragedy, which almost everyone has bemoaned, was the incredibly slow police response. Whereas most school shootings are stopped within minutes, the Columbine attack officially lasted for close to an hour, despite hundreds of officers from over 30 agencies being present.
Well, we know for sure the police did officially not go into that school. They did not attempt an entry until 45 minutes later when Harris Klebold died. And the question that has always dogged the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department is, why didn't the cops go in? They had a school resource officer there almost immediately. He was armed. He traded some shots with Harrison Klebold, and then he hunkered down the rest of the time behind the car in the parking lot. He did not do his job. He did not do his duty, and he should have followed those kids inside the school and tried to stop them before they killed innocent people. He clearly was derelict in his duty, but he got a pass too.
Although there were reports of officers attempting to enter prior to 12 o'clock, the first organized police entry did not come until the time when Harris and Klebold officially committed suicide. It was begun on the side of the school opposite where shots were last heard, and shots continued to be heard throughout the afternoon.
There was also a kind of confusion. The sheriffs initially said that they had officers in the school almost right away, inside the school, and then they were inexplicably pulled out again. Why, we don't know. The first 911 call was made within a couple of minutes. Of course, the school resource officer, this armed officer, he was there almost immediately on the scene. Within 5 minutes, you had seven or eight policemen from the local area were there. And within about 20 minutes, there were hundreds there. But despite that fact, no official entry was made until almost 45 minutes after the shooting started, and just about the same time that Harris and Klebold officially killed themselves. That's when you had the first SWAT team go in. And they started a very slow, methodical search, clear on the other side of the school from the library, on the other side from where the shots were being the last heard. An hour after that, another SWAT team started, entered another part of the school, the cafeteria, and they also did a very slow, methodical search of the school. They didn't get to where the shooters were, that would be the library, until about probably maybe 2:30 to 3 o'clock. And then, even then, the whole school was not considered secure until 4 p.m. that afternoon. That's almost 4 hours after the incident began. And even then, even after that, you still had bomb squads being sent in. Other SWAT teams were doing research of the school all the way till midnight that night. So, you know, what really happened, when the shooters died, when the scene was declared secure, is unknown. There were other reports that there were gunshots after 12:08 when Harris Klebold committed suicide. A lot of those people, suspects seeing gunshots being heard, explosions being heard, all the way till about 3:30 that afternoon. So was the situation over when Harris Klebold committed suicide at 12:08? I would think not. I think there were other people still alive. We really don't know what happened.
The explosives and gunfire, which could be heard coming from within the school until up to 4 that afternoon, were officially explained away as 6 to 8 shots fired by police to open locked doors.
That officially happened, about that many shot clock rounds. But that cannot account for all the shooting, though. There were explosions, they saw suspects, they heard multiple gunfire look like or sound like a shooting among suspects.
Having armed suspects alive in a school full of innocents for 3 to 4 hours while so many officials stood outside to secure the perimeter could look very bad for the authorities.
Well, I think they were trying to minimize their responsibility for stopping them. The later they're alive, the more time the sheriff has to account for them not being intercepted or killed.
According to several corroborating witnesses, at least one unidentified adult was also an attacker at Columbine. His or their roles in coordinating the attack and making sure it went to plan are unknown, but for their part, the Columbine Trenchcoat Mafia had been well known to school authorities as a troublesome group for years prior to the attack. Afterward, however, almost everyone on the faculty played this down as much as possible.
Yeah, the school didn't want to know anything about any kind of trench coat mafia. And, very few of their teachers ever commented on it or asked about it. Just like afterwards, almost nobody wanted to let go that they knew Harris and Klebold. You would have thought that Harris and Klebold had no friends in that school, but they actually did. They were not unpopular. But no, the trench coat mafia was a fairly visible presence at that school. I pointed out that the freshmen who had come from the junior high school the year previously, they had a high school orientation where the kids came down from Columbine and told them what to expect at the high school. And during that presentation, they were warned to stay away from the group with the trench coats, the trench coat mafia. You know, at that point, they had already developed such a bad reputation that these kids were specifically warned to keep away. You know, what had the trench coat mafia been doing the years previous that they had developed such a bad reputation? They had gotten into trouble, obviously. They had caused a lot of fights, which means, of course, the school would have been very aware of their presence and what they were up to.
The phenomenon of social outsiders wearing black trench coats as a symbol of separation emerged sometime in the early 90s. It has typically been accompanied by an interest in hateful music, drug abuse, and a dabbling in the occult. Many Columbine client murderers have worn trench coats during their attacks.
Yeah, and that had not started with Columbine. It had started about 8 years earlier. There was a trench coat satanic group of heavy metal musicians engaged in a minor rampage where they burned down historic churches, and they also killed each other and stuff. And that came out back in the early 90s out of Norway, believe it or not. And from that point on, you had the same phenomenon slowly take off in the United States, most noticeably in Columbine, and of course, ever since then, you've had multiple copycat-type attacks of trench-coated gunmen doing this.
Columbine is a very high-profile mass shooting with a lot of suspicious characteristics, but it isn't the only one cast from such a mold. The Dunblane, Port Arthur, and Gladio attacks, for instance, also seem to have much more to their stories than we were initially told by the governments charged with investigating them.
I'd say many of the random rate school shootings before and since Columbine have been, kind of covert ops in that same line. And you'll find many, many similarities, for example, from Red Lake to Northern Illinois University. And a lot of the church shooters have the same background, and the mall shooters. These are all kind of the same types.
One particular string of events occurred right around the time of the Columbine attack. Numerous bomb threats and plans for school shootings in Colorado and around the nation came to light just as Columbine was hitting the news. For instance, a message was left on the nearby Stein Elementary School answering system in Lakewood, which stated, "Yes, I'm one of the trenchcoat robbers, and if you don't give up $10 million, we're going to kill everybody in the school." Curiously, according to the police files from which this anecdote arises, the message was left not on April 20th, but the day before, April 19th.
I'm not sure what was being planned. It's possible they wanted to have multiple events at the same time, multiple school attack type events, and then it would later have been, they would have blamed the internet for allowing these groups to coordinate, and that would have been seen as part of a greater attack on the internet, perhaps resulting in even more laws or more regulation of the internet. It's also possible that the conspirators set up multiple teams to do the job. If one team should perhaps fail or fall out, they'll have another team ready to go. For example, if they plan an event in Georgia at the same time, if that Georgia group didn't work well, the Colorado group would take over. I'm not sure how they was coordinated. I just don't think it's coincidence that you have so many similar events right before and right after, as I said, in the Denver area and then around the United States. As to what the relationship is exactly, I could not tell you. But perhaps tellingly, the most significant thing is the authorities refused to really investigate these things. Jefferson County was being flooded with reports of possible related activity in other parts of the country, and they just, you know, didn't put two and two together. They just filed it away. And that's sadly typical of the Jefferson County investigation. They got so many leads, so many clues, and they just filed them away, never ran them down, never investigated. And that, of course, is to get more evidence of a cover-up.
There are many very important facts about Columbine which have been deeply suppressed by the government and media, which have access to all of the information Rolf and his colleagues have and more. Instead of honestly investigating the shooting, the government swept all the loose ends under the rug and busied itself with forcefully advancing a reactionary agenda. Meanwhile, the media contented itself with brutalizing audiences further via tasteless coverage of the attack, which regularly included phrases such as, "a grisly tableau of young bodies, a bloodied young man dangled, and a bullet slammed into her skull."
Well, you have to remember that Columbine was a political event. I believe it was conducted to achieve political ends. And to achieve political ends, you have to have maximum emotional impact upon the body psyche. So, of course, all the TV cameras were focused on the school. It was the subject of mass publicity in the months afterwards. So it was mined for everything it's worth. And such an event becomes part of the collective memory of the nation. And if you look at the problem-reaction-solution theory, that first you have the problem, the reaction was the mass hysteria afterwards. There was the rubbing of our noses into the violence that these kids, these innocent children, had to endure. And, of course, the solution was ever stricter laws governing school, ever more laws governing our acquisition of firearms. So to achieve political ends, you have to traumatize the masses. Just like 9/11, the nation was collectively traumatized over and over again. If there had been no cameras, there would have been, you know, no massive reaction, no excuse to make political changes afterwards. To have a political event to achieve this massive shock value, the choice of children as victims becomes clear. That to achieve that kind of maximum shock, you have to have innocent victims. And the children, of course, are better than anybody else. I mean, we all want to rally around and save the children. My God, the children should not have to endure this. So to achieve that maximum shock value, children have to be the target, which is why we've seen school attacks over and over again. When the one school attack doesn't achieve the desired ends, i.e. being a push for more gun control, you hit them again and again. You mentioned earlier Dunblane in England, Port Arthur in Australia. These were massive random raid shooting events that achieved their objective immediately, which was gun control in both cases. So those nations really weren't hit again and again with these school shooting events. But we, of course, we have our gun Second Amendment culture. We are hit repeatedly every 6 months now, it seems like. I'm gratified to say that we still don't have that gun control, because I think to do that would be to let the conspirators achieve their desired goals. I think the American people are a little bit tougher than the people in England and Australia. They know what the agenda is.
Many repressive suggestions for change acquired support as a result of the horror caused by the Columbine attack, from the banning of the private ownership of firearms to filling the school with police officers operating under zero-tolerance principles, to forcing psychiatric behavior modification onto young children. The political fallout from attacks like Columbine seems to follow a definite pattern, not just in America, but internationally.
The agenda consists of several parts. Now, the most important, of course, is a demand for more gun control, and meaning the chipping away at our Second Amendment rights. And we've seen that in the wake of Columbine. They closed the gun show loophole. There's been other laws about how to get guns, acquire guns. And they're not attacking the Second Amendment outright. They're just chipping away at it every chance they get. Oftentimes now more at the local and state level than on the federal level, because federal gun control efforts get a lot of publicity. But now they're doing it state by state, which is harder to combat. That's one aspect of it. Another aspect is this push to turn all of our schools into something resembling medium security institutions, with their lockdown drills, their pat downs, you know, all this hysteria for security, this mania, which is consuming ever more of the school children's time. And I think the lesson here is to kind of traumatize the kids with this kind of stuff, to emphasize that at any moment the bad guys can come out and get you, thereby necessitating an ever heavier security and police presence, which is kind of education for the future, really, because that's where our society is going. We have security guards, metal detectors in schools, and what do we see on the streets now? More and more guards, more and more uniformed officers with guns. All necessary, you know, because of these false flag attacks. And also maybe a third reason might be a push to get these kids drugged up as much as possible. You might be aware that the proportion of children on drugs has been climbing very rapidly in the last 20 years. I'm talking Ritalin, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, and all that has been helped by the perpetration of the image of a damaged school child who's not thinking correctly and who needs to be saved from himself through the application of these drugs.
If the state is involved in cover-ups as high-profile as the Columbine attack, it cannot jeopardize its credibility with a full confession. As such, reinvestigations typically only provide a few quality pieces of information and a lot of limited hangouts. Instead, a more widespread grassroots discussion of the suppressed evidence in crimes like Columbine may help to bring a resolution.
First, I wanted the truth to be known and the reinvestigation to be reopened and the guilty parties caught. That's not going to happen. All we can hope for now is that a certain segment of the population becomes aware that view will gradually grow and grow quietly. But no, the government's never going to own up to what's going on.
If there had been no patsies, Columbine would have been much more difficult to disguise as a teen-generated incident. Young people should take note that there are more pitfalls and traps strewn around the social landscape today than ever before, and the stakes concerning what can go wrong have never been higher. By caring for each other and ourselves, we may be less vulnerable to exploitation by a conspiracy seeking to cause our downfall.
I say it's okay to wear the outfit and to have the look, but don't let yourself be used by some very evil people lurking in the background who just want to use you to advance a political agenda. So many of these young school shooters, I do feel that they're being manipulated and controlled somehow. When you adopt this violent, nihilistic ideation, you may come to the attention of some bad people who want to use that reputation of yours for their own ends. That's all I can say. And stay away from the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, most of all. Stay out of the system's clutches. Once you're in, they can do what they want with you.
This has been Evan Long for evanlong.tk and thecolumbinecause.tk. Thank you for listening, and if you found this information useful, please spread it to your open-minded friends and family members.